Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in this show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. I think you will. Hey everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birch. We have a very special guest here. We've been trying to get him on the show for a long time, and honored to have him on. It's Jason DeMarco. He's the Vice President and Creative Director on air for Adult Swim, which our fans, the listeners of the show, will understand. That is where Toonami lives, which is something all of us pay a lot of attention to. Jason, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So I kind of want to start maybe from the beginning, just so people understand sort of who you are.
Sure.
Your reign, at least according to the bio that the network sent over, your reign began doing the packaging for the original run of Dragon Ball and Pokemon on Cartoon Network, right?
No.
Oh. Well.
I actually began working for TNT in 1996, right out of college. And while I was at TNT, I was friends with Sean Akins, who is the co-creator of Toonami.
Mm-hmm.
So in our spare time during my job at TNT, and then he got hired at Cartoon Network, we came up with Toonami together. So then for a couple of years, I worked on Toonami at night while Sean was building the Toonami team. And then in 1998, I transitioned to Cartoon Network full-time and worked on Toonami from then on for the next, you know, till 2008 when Toonami was canceled the first time.
Right. Okay. And so back in those days, I mean, obviously you were I make the assumption that you were a fan of anime heading into all this.
No, hated it. No, I'm just kidding. back in those days, it was much harder to find, and we would go to, myself and Sean Akins in particular, would go to the local Japanese video store and check out stuff that was not even subbed or dubbed, just to watch it, like, you know, Dragon Ball Z movies particularly come to mind. But and then obviously all throughout my childhood, I've been a fan of anime since I saw Star Blazers when I was a kid. I was definitely a fan.
And what about, I mean, so we're in those earlier days when Toonami was sort of just getting off the ground, what was your original pitch?
At the time, what we were asked by Mike Lazo, who runs Adult Swim currently, we were asked to create an action cartoon block to replace, I can't remember what the name of the action cartoon block we were replacing was, but it was something really goofy. And at the time, sort of Rob Sorcher, who now is the head of programming for Cartoon Network, he actually ran Cartoon Network back then. And Mike Lazo had just come on board about a year before from TBS. And they were trying to sort of inject some new life into, you know, Cartoon Network and make it a little more relevant than sort of just playing old Hanna-Barbera cartoons. So we were given the task of creating a block of action cartoon programming based around kind of whatever they could grab at the time, and then a couple shows that we asked for. And the idea was to create sort of a lifestyle block of action cartoons. I wish I could dig up the original pitch video that Sean made, but it was pretty hilarious. It was like kids skating and like Spawn comic books and and Dragon Ball Z stuff. It was sort of like, we're going to put all this cool stuff in one block, you know, and I don't think at the beginning the network really knew what the hell we were trying to do, but I think they trusted Sean and just let him do something weird.
Wow. Okay. And well, so you said stuff that already existed, and then you pitched maybe pulling in a few shows yourself. Was that something that were those shows that would be localized for Toonami?
Oh, no, no, no. At the when we first started out, there was no money. It was very little money. So we're talking like Robotech and Thundercats were like our big, like those were like the feathers in our cap at the time.
You right, know? Yeah.
We were super psyched we got Robotech. We were just, we couldn't even believe it. So yeah, this was well before there was any talk of the network paying enough money to localize anything.
Right. Wow. Yeah, that was a long time.
It's a different time, different era.
Yeah, no kidding. So as Toonami sort of evolved over the years, eventually you got into stuff like, you know, I remember the Midnight Run, you know, where you would have quote unquote unedited, you know, Gundam Wing and stuff like that on late at night.
Yep.
When did you realize that there was a market for that? Where it was like, okay, the kids who watch this stuff in the afternoon, like half of these people are like 16 or older. So we want to try marketing to them like a Midnight Run.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was kind of when Gundam Wing in particular did really well. And Gundam Wing was the first show we thought, hey, why don't we just try to do a less edited version at night? Because it just seemed like such a shame to take out all the stuff I really liked, which was the violence. You know, it was looking at the demos of our shows. We were skewing a little bit older than Cartoon Network, sort of their core target at the time, which was 6 to 11 year olds. We were skewing more 9 to 14s. So we always skewed a little bit older. And I think that, you know, knowing that more of the older kids watch later in the night, there was sort of an idea of like, well, we're doing really well with 9 to 14 year olds. Maybe we should see if we can catch them a little bit later in the night where they're not really being served. So that was kind of the initial inspiration behind the Midnight Run.
Was there any sense to it that, because I've been told this is kind of a truism now, where if your show is appealing outside of the demographic that the network wants, that's a dangerous place to be because you might not be on the air for much longer if you're not pulling in the demo they want?
I mean, that's partially true, but that is also a gross oversimplification. I mean, a show can do really well with the wrong audience, but not cost a lot of money, and still then it's worth getting that audience that you're not really going for because eyeballs are still better than no eyeballs. Or a show can not do what you need it to with your core audience, but cost a lot of money. Or maybe it's just a very difficult show to make in terms of the deals you had to make or whoever your partner was. Like, there's just a million factors that go in, and ratings are always the number one factor, but they are not the only factor, or sometimes even the most important factor. It's totally, every show is different and every show's creation is different and every network's expectation of that show changes from day to day. Like, I can't even tell you how complicated and weird the reasons for various shows succeeding or not succeeding or being perceived as succeeding or not succeeding are. It's crazy. Television doesn't make any sense.
So, like, the fan theories swirling around something like, you know, Legend of Korra must make you sort of shake your head. Like,
yeah, I totally get why fans like doing the armchair quarterback thing and like looking at ratings breakdowns and hearing about the stories and reading between the lines because they're not being given the full information because they can't be because no business can like open its doors to show everyone in the public their inner workings. You know what I mean? But, and I get why people do that, but I also think that, when I see stuff like that, networks have so much more demographic information and all other kinds of information than the public has about any show. And they're not going to reveal it all that you almost are never going to really know why a show did or didn't make it. You really aren't. And any story that is put out might not even be the real full story. Because there's just, you know, making a TV show involves hundreds of people and lots of decisions at all levels at networks. And it's just impossible to simplify it to what would make it easy for a layman to totally understand. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I think the biggest misconception is that there's a script for this sort of thing.
Yeah, no, there's no script. Yeah. You know, if there was a script for this sort of thing, I don't think anyone would have had, Two and a Half Men on TV for 15 years. You know what I mean? Like, it's just things work, things don't. And there's a lot of reasons why those things are the way they are, but you just roll with them as a network, you know, and it's a lot about the factors on a certain day.
In those early days, there was some space in between the Midnight Run stuff and when you started skewing even older with the Adult Swim run. You know, things like Cowboy Bebop. And this was right around the time of like the anime bubble in the U.S.
Yeah.
Which I'm sure you saw the rise and fall of that whole thing, you know, with a front row seat.
I mean, with us, for Adult Swim, when it first started and what they came to call Adult Swim Action, which is the Saturday night block where they would run a lot of the anime they picked up, it was sort of, we were all working on Adult Swim at the same time as we were working on Toonami, and Mike Lazo, the guy who runs Adult Swim, I mean, he was the person who greenlit Toonami in the first place, and he saw how anime succeeded on the kids' side, and he felt and believed, and still does, that there's an audience for anime and action cartoons on the adult side. And when he started Adult Swim, aside from all the original comedy stuff they were doing, he always wanted to try out some anime. And it just so happened that we were in the middle of making deals for some of these shows. You know, some of those early Adult Swim action shows were actually meant to be Toonami shows or Midnight Run shows. And it sort of was an idea that he wanted to try. Like, let's just see, you know, if Toonami is sort of considered a kids block, we've got this adult block. Let's try these cartoons and just see how they do. And, you know, obviously they worked. So that's why here we are 13 years later and anime has never not been on Adult Swim.
Right. So back in those days, now there's a conception out there that Cartoon Network is in general more interested in IP that they own. And this has been responsible for, you know, anime being removed from the, you know, after school, you know, time slots, things like that. And that the, you know, Adult Swim original programming takes precedence over any kind of anime programming because Cartoon Network doesn't own the IP and therefore can't merchandise it and can't monetize it. Is there truth to that? And, you know, is that generally how it works over there?
I mean, I think that's sort of a general truism in television. Right. No television network is going to spend more money on acquired content than content they own outright. That's just not smart business sense.
Right.
No matter how much they may like or identify with content that they are licensing, they're not going to want to spend as much money and effort promoting content that they don't own because they can't monetize it other than ratings. Which is important, but which is not the only way that a network monetizes their shows. So, yeah, I would say there's a general truth to it, but it's not specific to Cartoon Network or Adult Swim. And I would say that the reason that anime started disappearing from Cartoon Network is because people stopped watching it. I mean, there's, you know, it was disappearing from every other channel at the same rate, if not a faster rate, at the same time. So, you know, as you said, it's not, I don't look at it as even the rise and fall of anime. I just look at it as the rise and fall of content distribution platforms like Blu-rays and DVDs.
Right.
I think the DVD market and the Blu-ray, you know, to some extent, the Blu-ray market cratering, especially in anime in the U.S. and internationally, and then the rise of streaming at the same time and the ability to stream shows literally the day they air in Japan to see a sub, it sort of cuts the legs out from any network having any reason to run a show unless people flock to it. And less people are going to flock to it because they can see it already streamed from Japan. So it just became a harder thing to monetize for both distributors of anime and for networks that broadcast anime. So I think the rate of shrinkage of anime on Cartoon Network was about the same as everywhere else, really. But it certainly wasn't a bunch of people sitting in a dark room going, we don't like the anime, you know. They will show what people will watch, period. Right. So you could argue all day about how it was promoted or scheduling or things like that. But ultimately, the shows didn't – they started going away because people didn't watch them as much. And when you have an acquired show people aren't watching versus a show you spent a lot of money to create that maybe does a little better – you're going to go with the one that you own.
Yeah, that's sort of obvious when you think about it.
I mean, it always surprised me that people get so hurt when a show goes off of a network because to me, I work at the network and or any network, and I know if people watch the show, they wouldn't take it off the air, period. It's that simple. It's very democratized. If a show is a big-ass hit show, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah, there's no room for, like, spite.
No, that's not why shows get pulled. It's not because somebody said, I dislike this. You know, I mean, obviously sometimes you get a regime change at a network, but generally, if a show is working, you'd be a moron to pull a show off the air that is bringing in ratings because you're just saying, I don't care about this money. And that's just the opposite of the point of every network, which is to earn money.
Right. Except for, you know, the stuff you really hate. That's what goes on at like 4:30 in the morning, right?
Except in Adult Swim's case.
Right, yeah. So in those heady days when there was all kinds of money in the anime industry, you know, the middle of 2000s, how often were you being pitched at by licensors? There's very little we know about the way business operated back then between companies like Genion and Bandai and you.
Well, you know, in some ways, we were definitely being pitched way more. I mean, obviously, because at the time, getting a show on our air, we would pay decent money for a show, and then they would sell Blu-ray, they would sell DVDs, and maybe if it was a really kind of a hit show, they could sell product,
right?
You know, licensing merchandise. So we were getting pitched all the time, but it's still, in some ways, it's not entirely dissimilar to the way it is now because it was still based around personal relationships. You know, we were, I would say, pretty close with Bandai America. They worked very hard with us on Gundam Wing, and it opened the doors for a much larger long-term relationship that even now continues to bear fruit in the form of, like, Space Dandy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, business is still all about relationships. So there were certainly, we were being pitched all kinds of stuff all the time. But in terms of who we worked with, we worked with the people we felt good about and who we felt did the most for us and worked with us and that we could do the most for. And that's why we did, you know, that's why we did Ghost in the Shell with Production IG. Then we did IGPX with Production IG, you know, and then we did Big O with Bandai because we formed friendships based on mutual respect and just smart business, you know, acumen. So in that respect, it's not that much different. But otherwise, yes, they would come in with all the toys of whatever property. I mean, when we got pitched Gundam Wing, Kenny Adomi, who was you know, one of the top guys at Bandai America at the time, came in with an Epion Gundam fully built, you know, master grade kit, or maybe it was a high grade, but whatever, a model kit in a right. In along with a Wing Zero in these glass boxes, and then he brought a bunch of the toys just to illustrate, hey, this is a big thing in Japan, you know, in case we knew that, like Sean and I, but like a lot of other people in the room who would decide whether this show was worth the money did not. So, you know, they would do stuff like that. They were sort of big presentations, you know, PowerPoints of all about a show.
Right.
You know, so they don't really do that anymore.
Yeah.
We got brought to the dance a lot more often back then.
Now, there is an old story that goes out that people sort of repeat that I would love to put to bed. Is it true that there was any pay-to-play back then? That Bandai was, like, paying you to run something like Ghost in the Shell?
They wouldn't. I mean, that's not entirely untrue. I don't know which shows, but, I mean, there are some shows that they, and this happens at every network, there are some shows that a licensor will say, I just really want you to run this show. And we say, well, we're not that interested. And they say, well, what if we give you money? Because they have toys in the stores and they know that having the show on the air, that's sort of a not uncommon practice in the world of toy shows, particularly toyetic shows.
Right.
But I couldn't tell you what show that might have happened on. And certainly because I wasn't privy to, you know, all the business deals. I just would say, I like this show. You know, it was very rare in Toonami that we were told to air anything. We were usually asked, what would you like to show?
Oh, okay. So
it would be more like I don't think Hamtaro was a pay to play, but like Hamtaro would be one show we did not want to show on Toonami that the okay. network told us you're showing Hamtaro. But that was incredibly rare for us. But I would say it's an uncommon practice, but it's not an unusual practice. It's been going on since the dawn of television.
So it sounds like Toonami programming, at least the way the block was programmed, and I'm sure maybe this is still the case, it was largely, from your perspective, it was largely built on your own nose for quality and business.
It was sort of a combination of factors. It was like they, you know, at first it was definitely just literally Sean and I and Gil Austin, who I work with still on Toonami, saying, hey, here's the shows we think would be cool. And then the network going and hunting them down. Then we would start getting pitched shows as they were being made or right after they came out in Japan by, you know, trusted partners. Then slowly, as Toonami became a bigger thing, the programming department at Cartoon Network started becoming more familiar with anime in general because they kind of had to. And they were taking meetings all over the world. And then they would come back to us and say, well, this show and this show and this show, what do you think? And then it sort of became a back and forth where they were suggesting things to us and we were reacting to them. And then I would say towards the end of Toonami, it was almost more out of our hands by the end. It was like they just felt like, you know, for right or wrong, they felt like they knew the market and they had the shows and the deals that they thought made sense. And they would still check with us, but it wasn't quite as much us driving it. And now it's sort of back to the old way where Gil and I and Kim Manning, the head of programming for Adult Swim, we sit down and sort of decide together what we want.
Okay, so it's a little more holistic now.
Yeah, I mean, it's Adult Swim's just a smaller operation, and there's only one person who's the head of programming, and, okay, you know, we and she are the only people who really know much about anime at Adult Swim as far as, like, fans, because it's, you know, something we've known, we've been doing for years. So she will get pitched by companies sometimes, or sometimes we will hear from fans and go back to Kim and say, hey, can you look into this show? And then she'll find out for us, and we just kind of talk every week and sort of try to keep planning and bringing exciting things to the block with the budget that we have.
Right. So I've always been curious about this. Back in the day, you know, I mentioned shows that would run at like 4:30 in the morning. Back in the day, this was like mid-2000s, I think. There would occasionally Bandai shows would pop up. Something like, the, you know, original Mobile Suit Gundam, like Gundam 79.
Right.
And I think there was like a hack show, like Legend of Twilight Bracelet. And those, for some reason, ran at like butt o'clock. Like,
I don't know. I don't know which one. I mean, we did show two dot hack shows. But, you know, a lot of times the network will make a deal with a licensor and you promise to air all the episodes, but you don't promise where.
Okay.
And
yeah,
maybe the show's not doing really well in prime time, but you have to run it because you're contractually obligated to do so. So then you run it when you're not going to damage your ratings because no one's watching at 4 a.m. anyway.
Right.
but you still, you know, you're still fulfilling the letter of your obligation.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I think that was always the assumption generally that people inside the business made, but outside it was like, why are they doing this? Like a lot of confusion. Did you, during this period, like the mid-2000s, so, you know, you mentioned 2008 was when Toonami was canceled for the first time. Leading up to that, did you ever have a sense at how much it meant to people, how much it meant to fans? Toonami really is seminal for it. A lot of people, myself included, credit it with creating a mainstream anime fandom in the U.S. Did you ever have a sense of that? What you were doing was important and was creating an entire generation of teenagers who grew up loving this stuff?
Not at the time, to be honest. I mean, we were just working hard trying to make the best programming block we could. And, you know, occasionally when we went to an anime convention, we would get a nice reaction and it would make us think, oh, you know, people seem to be really liking it. But it was not a time where you had the immediate back and forth that you have nowadays with, yeah, you know, social media. So no, I would say we weren't really aware until Toonami's return, the April Fool's Toonami stunt was really the first time we really became aware of that. Up until then, we aren't people with big egos, so we weren't sitting around like, yeah, we're changing lives.
Right, yeah.
Just we're trying to do our job. And it was only later that we found out how many people had been, you know, raised on Toonami and how much some of those speeches and music videos meant to some of those kids at the, that time in their lives. You know, it's a very, you know, the age of 9 to 14 is a pretty formative time in anyone's life. And I think those memories are pretty pure for a lot of people. So that it really means a lot to them, even in their late 20s and 30s.
Right.
But it's not something we ever expected at all.
So leading up to the cancellation, was the writing on the wall, was this sort of a nadir for anime in America kind of in general? I mean, those were dark times for the industry, period.
Yeah, I mean, you mean leading up to Toonami's cancellation?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that we kind of knew, like, it was clear that the hours were shrinking and, you know, I mean, you never really know till they tell you. Like, we didn't know till, like, a couple days before. We only, like, we had maybe a week, but it wasn't a huge shock to us because we felt the market winding down. We could see that the ratings were down. We could see that the network was sort of pulling back from their commitment to buying new content for the block, which is understandable. And so we weren't, you know, we weren't totally shocked, but we also were not told till right before it went off the air.
So, you know, also in 2008, when Toonami was canceled, at that point you hadn't had, like, there hadn't been a big hit in a few years. Like, I think Fullmetal Alchemist had been, like, the most recent big success, and it had been a few years since then. And, you know, the obvious truism is that a big hit like that drives traffic for the rest of the block. How important is having, like, one huge success to Toonami? Will that keep it going, like, for a really long time?
I mean, it's important for Toonami to do well in the ratings, period. And whether that's one show or a bunch of shows, you definitely, I mean, there's a reason we're running DBZ Kai and Shippuden. That's right. because every week they pull a good number and lift whatever's around them. And I think we need that sort of tent pole so that we are allowed to have shows that are maybe less popular or a little bit or new to the network, that so we can keep trying to draw in new audiences while holding on to the people who just want to tune in every week for their regular show. And I would say that's kind of the same with any programming block, you know, whether that's must-see TV in the 90s or, you know, right, like anything. You need that sort of driving show, whatever that is, and then you build around that. And that's what Fox did with American Idol for years. I mean, that's just sort of – that's TV 101, really. So, yeah, I mean, we could probably survive without a show that did great numbers every week, but it certainly doesn't hurt.
Right. And most recently you had, you know, probably the biggest success to come down the pike in a long time, Attack on Titan, which we got a few questions wondering about, you know, the fact that that has been recently pulled from the schedule. Do you feel like the longevity of reruns right now is just shorter than it used to be?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anime has ever rerun very well, to be honest.
Well, aside from, like, Cowboy Bebop, right?
Yeah, but I mean, even Cowboy Bebop didn't do great in reruns. It did okay, but we just loved the show and kept it on.
Oh, okay.
But it just got to a point where we couldn't do that anymore. But yeah, I think in general, people think that comedy reruns better than drama or serialized television because you can tune in and never have seen the show before. And you know, like a show like Law and Order will rerun really well, or a show like Cheers. But a show like Breaking Bad doesn't rerun as well because it's so dependent on you knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think most anime, at least that we show, they have these long building storylines, and it's pretty, you know, I think once people make their way through a bunch of episodes, they're not that likely to tune back in randomly to watch some reruns. And I think it's kind of been that way since way back in Toonami. It was just that I think anime was a bit of a more new and exciting thing to some of our viewers then, and it wasn't as readily available to literally Google any show they want to watch and run it on their computer.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that's part of just the way the market is now. And it's that anime doesn't rerun that well. And that's why we try to find broad shows with a lot of appeal that have great action and a little bit of comedy. And, like, we're looking for the perfect channel surfing shows, because you know, half of our audience every week is made up of people who watch every week, and the other half is just whoever's watching Adult Swim at that moment. Mm-hmm. And we're just trying to, we're always trying to hold the viewers we have while getting new viewers. Like, we're always trying to think about the viewer who isn't a huge anime fan, because we have to serve them too if we're going to stay on the air.
Right, and if they turn on Adult Swim and it's episode 15 of Attack on Titan, they're going to be completely lost.
Yeah.
And change the channel.
That's exactly right.
Yeah, so maybe not a great rerun. But, you know, that I did strongly for you in its first run, I believe. So, yeah, I guess it's worth running these things once.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about your original productions. You know, throughout the mid-2000s, you had you're credited with Big O. Do you consider that to be like a Cartoon Network, you know, original?
Well, no. I mean, I did executive produce that show, and my contribution was more steering the story a little bit, because it was going to be even crazier, and I will confess that we sort of asked the creators, like, can you just pull back just a teeny bit, because it's already pretty crazy. I remember very distinctly having a conversation with them, and I said, you don't have to tell people why things are happening, but you do have to tell them what is happening. And they were like, oh, okay. And it sort of changed the way the shape of the show a little bit. But and you know, I was involved with the dub, but not super heavily. It was more that we love Big O. We convinced Mike Lazzo to invest in a season 2 of Big O, and that we could premiere it as an Adult Swim action original. And he said, okay, yeah, sure. You manage the relationship, since you know those Bandai guys. And so I ended up just executive producing it, but it wasn't a super like day-to-day job. It was more of a gentle guiding hand.
And the obviously the way that deal worked out, it wasn't IP that Cartoon Network that Turner would own, right?
I mean, no, yeah, just that we would. I mean, we could show Big O to the end of time that season.
Okay.
So we don't own it, but we also can run it forever,
right,
without having to worry about paying money because we paid for that season. But yeah, it's not considered Cartoon Network IP.
So, I mean, in that, you know, knowing that, then, are you personally, like, kind of excited to get, if it, I mean, I imagine they're going to do a Blu-ray release, because it has been relicensed.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to have the Blu-ray of season 1 and 2, for sure. Just, you know, curiously enough, it's these kind of shows, since there's so many different people involved in making it, because it was created for the American market, but it was by, you know, animated obviously in Japan, mm-hmm. and created in Japan, but then Bandai America was involved and they're not around anymore. And so it's sort of, the rights are this complex web. So I never hear about something getting licensed until it's released publicly.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, for me, it's going to be, I'll just be buying it like any other consumer.
Well, maybe they'll pull you in to do commentary tracks.
Yeah. I mean, I'd love to, but I also don't expect them to, and I don't, you know, I wouldn't be annoyed or anything. Like, it's fine. It's had its day.
Just call your buddies at Funimation and say, hey.
Yeah.
So Big O sort of begat, in an indirect way, IGPX, which was the big, you know, that was your big, co-production? Yeah. I mean, how would you characterize that?
Yeah, it was a co-production.
Right.
It was that we considered more of an original because we weren't the only... It was called the IGPX Production Committee. There was like 5 partners, but we were the biggest partner and the sort of driving force. But yeah, co-production.
Right. And every time I've ever asked anyone who ever worked on IGPX, they kind of get this 1,000-yard stare, and they're sort of like, well... You know, there was no reason for that to not be a massive success.
Yeah, I mean...
Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, like, what was your experience like working on that show?
Oh, we had a blast. I mean, everyone that worked on it, from Hongo-san, you know, the entire Japanese team, to the guys at Bang Zoom who dubbed it with us, you know, the voice actors, the writers, we all had just a, it was a really great, fun show to work on because, you know, whether or not it succeeded in what it was trying to do, I think is definitely an arguable point, but we definitely did a few things unlike the way anyone had done them up until that point, you know what I mean? And we were working with one of the best animation studios in the world, Production IG. We were creating a story that we wanted to run simultaneously in two different countries. We were and tailoring it for each of those markets. We were trying to have a cast of voice actors that were not the usual suspects of anime voice actors and pull in people that had never done anything like this before, like Michelle Rodriguez or Lance Henriksen or Haley Joel Osment. And we were trying to have music that you would never have heard in any anime before, and I would argue you still haven't heard anything like the music in IGPX in an anime. So I think we definitely achieved a lot of the things we set out to, but I think we were a little, you know, we were overly ambitious maybe. It was a lot of hard work, but I think everyone that worked on it was happy with the product and wished it had done better. You know, in retrospect, I wonder if it was the smartest decision to say, I want to make a sports anime but with giant robots. So I think what people wanted from us was giant robots with guns that were shooting at each other. And when it became obvious, it was almost sort of a slice of life, you know, sports anime, but it happened to be that they were in robots. I think it just was too much for people to wrap their heads around. It's a show that doesn't fit into any easy categorization. And, you know, and then it's hard. It's hard dubbing. It's hard doing a simul dub. I was blown away at how good the simul dub for Space Dandy is because having done it, it's really hard.
Right.
To have a dub that is as good as, you know, a sub and basically feels true to the original intent of the writing.
Yeah. Yeah. The story everyone pulls out whenever they talk about IGPX is it's like, well, that pilot film, you know, it's not quite what the actual show was. And
no, that's true. Yeah. And that was actually a left turn for us. That was Hongo coming back and saying, hey, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do robots just shooting at each other. There's too at the time there were tons and tons of giant robot shows. Mm-hmm. And he said, I want to do something different. I'm obsessed with racing and I want to do racing and fighting. And we thought, oh, cool. Yeah. That's not this, you know, we actually liked it, but yeah, people have told me before, like they felt like they really liked the micro series, as we called it,
right.
And they wish that it had been more like that. But I don't think I would have wanted to make that show. And I think the show we made was more interesting to me as a person who likes giant robots.
Well, in a sense, you got to make both.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly.
So you got to see both versions of it kind of come to life, and that's cool.
Yeah, I'm happy. We ran all 26. You know, we got two seasons out of it. I'm not complaining.
So that I guess brings us to Space Dandy, and I'm extremely curious, like, what exactly was Cartoon Network's creative input on Space Dandy? Did you have any?
No, almost none. I mean, we were friends. We were still friends with Kenny Adomi, who was the executive producer, and he came, you know, he brought the whole team to Atlanta and pitched us the show, and we just, I mean, based on the pedigree of everyone involved and the fact that we had already worked with all of them, and they didn't want that much money. Based on all of those, it was sort of a no-brainer. We just said, yeah, do it. And then we didn't give them any creative notes because I just felt like that wouldn't have been appropriate.
Right.
Not with that team. You know, we weren't a major, we definitely co-funded it, but we were not a major partner. So when they came to us, they kind of had everyone on board almost already. So we were just the last piece in place for it to air in the U.S. So we didn't feel like it was our place to comment, both because it didn't need our comments and right. Because we weren't really spending enough money to be ordering people around.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And so at the pitch stage, you felt like this was a pretty good fit.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, just looking at the time, it was just sketches and outlines of, you know, it was like Dandy and some of the other, not even all the main characters, some of the other characters, and then just plot outlines of like potential episodes. but we just knew, you know, the pedigree of the guys who had worked, on these shows. I mean, they're responsible for some of the shows that have done the best on Adult Swim action, right, and some of our favorite shows. So we were just like, yeah. So yeah, it was kind of a no-brainer.
Yeah, well, I mean, so at the pitch stage, they were telling you, like, this is not a serial story, and that must, you know, with all the people involved and the basically the theme, the way the show looks, it kind of seems like the perfect show for Adult Swim, really, if, you know, if you put that into, like, a little bubble.
Yeah, I mean, we knew, and they made it clear it was going to be goofy, not always goofy, but that it would be goofy and have a lot of self-contained episodes and have a story that never really made sense. And we you know, we thought all of that was sounded delightful.
Right.
So, and it was.
That's excellent. Okay, so before we get to the Twitter questions here, what is happening with Toonami right now? Everyone's panicking because you just cut the hours.
Yeah.
Pretty dramatically, and that's kind of what happened, you know, last time it was canceled.
Yeah.
So what's going on?
Basically, it was just the network's decision because our back half was just not, you know, it doesn't need to do really well the later hours, but they were doing steadily worse, you know, from about December or late, you know, November, really from Thanksgiving on, because the holidays always disrupt viewing patterns, mm-hmm. and then we had movies. And in the back half, we were just showing shows that we've shown so many times. I think it was just really hard for us to retain an audience. And I think they recognize that, but we don't have the money to fill 6.5 hours with all premieres. That's just not feasible.
Right.
So they just made the decision that, you know, hey, we can put other stuff here that will do better, that we don't have to spend money on. And Toonami can be 3.5 hours of solid premieres, which is what we at Toonami always wanted. We did not ever want a 6.5 hour block because we knew we wouldn't have enough to sustain it. And I think it's a miracle we lasted at 6.5 hours as long as we did. We originally wanted Toonami to be 3 hours, 6 shows, all premieres, once a week. That to us is, with the staff we have, that's about as much as we thought we were capable of handling. The network was who wanted to try 6.5 hours or 6 hours initially, and it worked for a while, but eventually we were running the same shows and we lost the rights to some other shows. Cartoon Network wrote off some shows we were showing and just sort of cut the legs out from under it, and to a point where it wasn't worth the network spending the money to revitalize it when they knew they could just put other stuff that they wouldn't have to pay for in that same slot. And then they wouldn't have to change their commitment to getting the same amount of new stuff for Toonami, because we always focused the premieres in the first 3 hours of Toonami anyway, because that's when 90% of our audience is watching. So,
right.
Look, anything can happen. If our ratings really tank tomorrow and are bad for weeks, then yeah, we'll probably shrink again. But for now, we're doing really well. The network has no desire for Toonami to go away. They have told us point blank, you're not going anywhere. We've got Intruder 2 planned this year. We've got a couple sales promotions. So Toonami's not going anywhere for a while, as long as people watch it.
Cool. So basically it sounds like this is just a much easier block to curate and a little truer to your personal vision for what would actually work.
Absolutely. I mean, we were not sad about it. We knew the fans would be sad, and we were sad that we had to rip off shows that people were watching.
Right.
Because, you know, there's always that person who's never seen Cowboy Bebop before.
Yeah.
And they're now had it disappear from their schedule. So that's a bummer. But we didn't control that. And other than that, we were actually relieved because we realized, oh, good, we can spend more time on the premieres and making this 3.5 hours really solid. And for us, that's a really good thing. It's hard for the viewer to understand that, but that's actually, we prefer it this way.
Right. Well, it makes sense. You know, I think, you know, I've been doing this about 15 years, and I would look at the Toonami lineup, and it's like, how are they still showing that?
Yeah.
It's like, damn.
Yeah, and we feel the same way. But at the same time, you can't realistically go to a network and say, we need you to pay for a new show. Okay, what time? 4 in the morning. Okay. You mean when everyone else is running infomercials or yeah. Cheers reruns or stuff that doesn't matter that they didn't spend money on because everyone's asleep?
Right.
You want us to spend good money on that? And it was sort of impossible. It was sort of an impossible ask.
Yeah. So how did you come to the schedule that you currently have? Obviously some shows that people were a little surprised to see some of the shows that had been yanked from repeats.
I mean, the schedule we currently have is pretty simple. All of the shows that are on have not been on Adult Swim before. So that was really the,
right,
you know, we've never shown Kai. We've shown Shippuden when we were doing Cartoon Network, but, you know, and not on Adult Swim and not uncut. One Piece we are in, and we are in episodes that never aired on Cartoon Network before. Dead Man Wonderland is the only one that's a rerun, and even that aired 2 years ago. So it's been a while, and we just wanted to bring it back for fans. Kill la Kill is obviously a premiere show. Mm-hmm. Inuyasha, the final act, has never aired on Adult Swim before. So the decision was basically, look, new always does better. So we kept everything new plus Dead Man Wonderland.
Right.
And everything else had been run so much that there wasn't, it just, what, they weren't pulling ratings, you know. So we're running the shows that have the best chance of doing well, and they have been doing well, thankfully.
Right. Interesting. So when you saw Kill la Kill for the first time, were you like, well, we got to get this.
I loved it. I honestly did not think we would be able to show it.
Right.
And in fact, I got yelled at by a lot of fans because we were at MomoCon last year and someone asked us about it. And I said, I don't picture that passing our censors, you know? Mm-hmm. And they were just like, Jason DeMarco doesn't like Kill la Kill, you know? which is not true. I like the show a lot. I did not imagine we would ever be able to show it. But luckily, our standards at Adult Swim in the later hours are a little looser than they used to be, so we can get away with more, you know. So we are able to show it, which I'm really happy about. I mean, obviously, there's a few scenes that are going to have to be edited because there's stuff in that show that we can't really show on Adult Swim. It just doesn't pass our network standards.
Right.
But for the most part, it's going to be, we're not messing with it.
Yeah, well, the show is kind of deceptively a little chaste. Like, there's a whole lot of almost nudity, but it never really gets over into full-on, you know.
Right, and there's no, yeah, and it's not, you know, there's no, you know, there's not a lot of detail even when there is nudity. And
right.
Our argument to the network was like, hey, Attack on Titan has giant naked people running around, and that's okay.
Right.
You know, so we showed that, didn't get one complaint. And then, you know, we showed Hellsing Ultimate, which has some pretty insane stuff in it.
Yeah.
And between those two shows, I think those shows in Black Lagoon sort of pushed the envelope enough for the network to feel comfortable with Kill la Kill.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the biggest argument I heard, which was like, well, you know, they're showing Hellsing Ultimate, which has content in it that pushes a hard R rating. Like,
yeah.
You know. Yep. All right, let's go ahead and get to these Twitter questions.
Cool.
I got a few of them for you here. Well, no, I like this one. Okay, Kiri Elson asks, do you think that Nielsen ratings will be replaced for a different metric that's more viable in 5 to 7 years or so?
I would be surprised. I think Nielsen is the industry standard, and everyone kind of has agreed on it, and the idea of something supplanting it would mean it would require a whole bunch of giant corporations to agree on the same standard of measurement. And, you know, look, the rest of the world uses the metric system. America doesn't. So it's like,
right.
I think once you're so far down a certain path, I think what's more likely is that Nielsen will change the way they do business slowly but surely to reflect more of the current market, like they've already been doing. But I think they're going to learn to move a little faster because, you know, the media landscape is moving faster every year. But I don't think Nielsen's going anywhere.
Well, that actually leads into the next question, which you got a lot of this. A lot of people wanting to know how the ubiquity of streaming anime, which is sort of where the anime industry has gone, how that has impacted Toonami.
I mean, it's impacted Toonami in a huge way. I think our shows, the choices of shows we could show, because some of those deals are exclusive for some of those streaming services. Netflix will sometimes make an exclusive deal so that if you are putting your show on Netflix, you can't put it on a broadcast network.
Really?
They also have way more money right now to throw around at programming because they don't have to report ratings.
Yeah.
and they can use all the investment capital that they have to throw money to secure pretty much any show they want, way more money than we could ever hope to spend. There's a whole subset of fans now who just say, well, I'll watch it on Crunchyroll. Why would I bother watching it on TV? I'm not an old man. You know what I mean? Like, streaming in general has changed the way, particularly younger people, you know, how they consume media. And when you're a kid and you can fire it up on your laptop literally anytime you want, it's hard to make an argument that you should wait once a week to tune in at an exact time. That just is going to feel like the past to a lot of a subset of viewer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's no question. I think it's a great thing for consumers in a lot of ways, but I think it's terrible for anime broadcast and anime reaching a wider audience in general, because there is still no better mass market device than television. And on the internet, if you want to see something, you have to know you want to go see it. Mm-hmm. TV is one of the only remaining, you know, media consumption devices where you are served something up that you might not have asked for, that you might catch on to and like. And that is how we created so many anime fans, and that is disappearing, frankly.
Well, so do you think that's going to lead to more deals like what we saw with Space Dandy, where the first place to see it is Toonami?
It might. Space Dandy was a bit of an unusual deal in that everybody knew each other and we sort of got along so great. If they didn't know us, I think it would have been a totally different deal. So I think people have asked me, like, when's the next Space Dandy type thing? And honestly, that wasn't just about the distributor Funimation being so great. That was about us knowing from even all the way down to who was animating it. We knew everyone involved, so it was just very easy. And they allowed us to not pay a lot of money because they knew that we would push the show and they knew that it would be good for the show's profile. But not every company feels that way in Japan. Certainly all the major publishers in Japan don't necessarily feel that way, you know, and they're not about to give away their IP to us just because it might increase the, you know, the overall viewership of something. They don't care about that. They mostly care about their market. So for us, I think Space Dandy is a peek into something you might see more often in the future. And I hope we see it more often in the future, but I don't know for sure that it's like going to change the way anime is released.
Well, it sounds like that was an example of the stars aligning perfectly.
It really was. Yeah. I mean, you know, you're hearing more about simuldubs now, and as far as people like Funimation, that was a test for them. How quickly can we dub a show? How quickly can we turn a show around so that the lag time between when it aired in Japan and when it's ready for an American audience is as small as humanly possible? That's very smart, and I think eventually all dubbing will happen like that. I just don't know that that immediately translates to those shows getting on television. That just might mean that they go to the streaming services as dubs faster, you know?
So like Funimation right now, they're dubbing about half, well, more than that, a lot of their current simulcast offerings. Most of those premiered this week.
Yeah.
Does them producing that content have potentially make it a quicker transition to Toonami?
It doesn't hurt,
okay.
You know, like it definitely doesn't, that definitely means that those shows go to the top of the queue of what we want to look at. You know, whereas with like Kill la Kill, we knew we wanted Kill la Kill like a long time ago. And the dub took a while coming.
Right.
And so, you know, it's the shorter that window can be, the better. And certainly those shows are shows we're going to look at right away because we know that they're going to be ready soon.
Right. Yeah, so they can come to you at the end of the run of something like Death Parade and say, like, hey, we have this ready. It's ready right now.
Yep.
That's a bonus. All right. Excellent. A lot of people asking about how in the world you obtained Sword Art Online 2 this quickly.
You know, we just have a good relationship with Aniplex, and they came to us very early on because they were very happy with the result. You know, Aniplex is one of the few people who were forward-thinking enough to say, hey, we know you don't have a lot of money to spend on a show, but we want to put it on the air because we think we will sell more Blu-rays because they obviously do those high-end Blu-ray packages. And they said, we think we will sell more Blu-rays and it will be better for the show overall if it is on a broadcast network. And they were right. So they were really happy with the first season of Sword Art and sort of how it lifted the profile of the show for them. And they came to us very early on and said, would you be interested in the second season? And we said, yes. So that's actually something we knew about in a deal that had been done forever. Just because we get along really well with Aniplex and they trust us and we trust them and we have a really good working relationship.
Cool. All right. Got a question here. AngelXO3 asks, how much of an overlap are there between people who watch Toonami Weekly and the ones who watch other regular Adult Swim programming on a regular basis?
I would say there's not a huge overlap. I mean, Toonami's audience is a lot of really loyal Toonami fans. It's right. A lot of loyal anime fans. And then it's people who are like, what is this crazy shit that's on the air right now? You know, I mean, I've met a lot of Adult Swim fans who also watch Toonami, so I don't think it's like there's no crossover, but I don't think it's as much as you might imagine, given that they share network space. But Toonami has always been its own vibe and feel, and it feels very different from everything else on Adult Swim, and our programming is very different, so it kind of really sticks out like a sore thumb, and I think our content in general, you're either going to be down with or you're not. You know, I know plenty of people who just don't care for anime or don't want to see action cartoons, who don't want to tune into Adult Swim for something serious. They just want to relax and see comedy. Mm-hmm. So I would say there's not a crazy amount of overlap, but there's some.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little obvious. It's like, well, let's put Attack on Titan next to Loiter Squad. And yeah. Are the audience for these two things the same? No.
Yeah, I will say that they're the same age.
Yeah, sure.
And that, you know, demographically, they're a similar person, but they just have different tastes.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Let's see here. SLDY93 asks, you once live tweeted Toonami when your favorite episode of IGPX aired. Will you ever do that again?
Maybe. You know, I'm actually not the biggest fan of live tweeting.
Really?
I kind of, as a Twitter user, I get kind of annoyed when people live tweet because my feed fills up with whatever they're talking about. And unless I'm super into whatever they're talking about, I generally don't care. The mute function changed that a lot because you just mute somebody while they're live tweeting and unmute them a couple hours later. But I also don't – it'd have to be something special. I don't say I would never do it again, but it's got to be like, you know, like my favorite episode of IGPX was a good reason. So maybe there'll be another show that – you know, Kai might have some episode I would want to do it in, but I don't have any plans. It was totally an off-the-cuff kind of thing.
Right. Okay. MC Taz asks, unrelated anime, a while back Adult Swim ran bumps featuring music by Jay Dilla. Were you involved in airing those, and if so, what was the motivation?
Yes, I was involved in airing those. My motivation was I've been a lifelong fan of Dilla's music before that album even, Donuts, and I was working closely with the label Stone's Throw Records that put out that album already. I was working with them on a compilation we did called Chrome Children, and I'm friends with all the guys at the label, and when I was there working with them, they played Donuts for me before it was released, and I knew that it would be a classic record, and I was immediately like, we got to get these beats on TV. And right after we sort of made the deal to do that, Dilla passed away. And then our video we made a video for a Jay Dilla song on Chrome Children called Nothing Like This. And that video came out not long after his passing. So for me, it was very much a personal thing. But when I played the music for Mike Lazzo and for the guys who do the Adult Swim bumps, they were like, oh, yeah, we got to use this music. So we just made a deal for a couple of years to use it, and people still bring that up.
Obviously.
It exposed a lot of people to Dilla, which I'm really happy about. That's something I'm very proud of.
Cool. Do you have time for a few more, or are we out of time?
I have time for a couple more, sure.
Okay. Ayanagi808 asks whether or not there was any trepidation picking up Sword Art Online, given the content in the second half of that first season.
Nah. No one cares about that except for a small group of people who decided to make it a big deal.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, like, no one – we aired that. We didn't get one complaint. I'm sure they're referring to the almost quasi tentacle scene.
Well, that and the, you know, implied incest.
Yeah. I mean, you know, we showed Helsing Ultimate, which has necrophilia in it, literal necrophilia. So, like, I really think that at the point at which where people draw those lines, they're kind of splitting hairs. And for us, no one cared when we aired it. We received no complaints. So we're not really afraid of whatever might be in Sword Art 2.
Yeah, well, by all accounts, it's much tamer. So the risque stuff, it's an anime. I mean, anime gets, you know, I'm sure you know, extremely risque, like to the point where there's obviously a lot of stuff you could never even think about airing. But I guess Sword Art Online kind of walks the mainstream line with it a little bit, enough to where...
You know, we won't be showing Urotsuki Doji anytime soon, but, like, you know, we can... You can imply things on almost any television network, regardless of how heinous they are.
Right.
It's when you start actively showing them that you have to make real decisions. And, you know, honestly, the shows that are pushing those envelopes the most were Helsing and now Kill la Kill. Much more than Sword Art ever did for us as a network.
Yeah. Well, so I guess we can all look forward to your live tweeting of the time Adult Swim runs Urotsuki Doji. Right?
Yeah.
Invalid Name asks, how do you find so much time and empathy for all the personal questions that you take on your Ask.fm page?
Oh, that's very nice. I don't know. I just feel like I just start, you know, I didn't ask because my daughter's on Ask.fm and I just sort of did it just to see what it was about. And I thought it would be a way for people to ask me not Toonami-related questions, and it might be fun. And then, like a year ago, I just started getting sort of people who had nowhere else to turn, who needed advice, just asking me stuff. And I just feel like I don't think I'm a super important person, but to the degree that I have a platform, if somebody needs help and it's just something as simple as a little bit of advice, then I just don't see why I wouldn't do my best to try to help them. I think that's just being a human being.
Right.
So I'm really happy that someone thinks that's nice. But, I mean, finding the time is easy. I mean, geez, like, I look at my ask.fm while I'm, like, waiting for dinner or, you know, like, you know, I'm in line at the bank. You know, like, it's totally a free time thing. So it's not like it doesn't take up that much of my time. And to be honest, I probably would have gotten off of ask.fm. off of Ask.fm by now if I wasn't getting those personal questions, because now I feel sort of a responsibility that if there's somebody out there who has a question, and I've gotten some really personal and tough ones, I just feel like if I'm the only person they're reaching out to, they kind of might need to hear something positive from someone. So that's just how I feel about it.
Yeah, so long as you're not just getting a flood of, why do you hate Bleach, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I mean, those I just block. Yeah, I'm an old hand at the social media, you know, haterism by now.
I'm sure.
It just rolls off my back.
I can't even imagine.
Sure, you know all about it.
All right, Michael Flynn asks, any chance we'll see more Western action shows on Toonami?
I'd say those are going to be more and more rare. I would say look at the market. There's not a lot of Western action shows, period, let alone ones that could air in Toonami. So our pickings are slim. I think I've said this before, but I think the revolution of CGI and Marvel movies and DC movies means that the kind of thing you could only see in cartoons before, you can now see on the big screen, and it's going to look a million times better and have a lot of money behind it. And I think that to some degree, young kids who used to grow up watching X-Men cartoons just go see X-Men movies now, or they go watch them. You can see Daredevil on Netflix, and then you can go watch Thor actually beat the crap out of Loki. You don't have to watch a cartoon. Right. And you can then go play with the officially licensed toy and read the comic book and play the video game and be immersed in that world in a way that even more than we ever could when we were younger. So I think to a certain degree that has largely cut out a lot of the action cartoon market, which was based on selling toys and comics and, you know, stuff that offering you things you couldn't see in the movies because they couldn't afford to have the Avengers in a movie when we were kids. Now they can. And I think that sort of fundamentally changed action cartoons going forward and made it so that there's going to be less and less of them, because our biggest movies every year, Guardians of the Galaxy is a giant action cartoon.
Yeah.
So as wonderful as it is, it's just a giant action cartoon. So when you can go see Guardians of the Galaxy, how likely are you then to tune into, you know, a cartoon version?
Yeah, a cartoon version that they didn't want to spend that much money on, and
right,
doesn't look as good as the TV as the movie does.
Right, and where the movie has 2 hours to put a tightly packed, powerful story together, the TV show has to do 22 half hours or 13 half hours or whatever. You know, it's just tricky, and it's expensive, more expensive than it's ever been. And I just think you're not going to see that happening as much on Toonami.
Okay, interesting. So moving forward, I guess, what would you tell people like to look out for this year? Like, what are you excited about on Toonami?
I can't talk about it.
Okay.
We have a couple acquisitions I'm really excited about, shows that people definitely will know. And then we also are very excited about The Intruder 2, which we are just, we wrote a while ago, but we're officially like animating now.
Cool.
I'm not sure exactly when that'll premiere, but it's going to be towards the end of the year, and we're really excited about that. That's going to fundamentally change Toonami for a while. And those are sort of that's really our big project this year is Intruder. And there's going to be an Intruder comic, which we've teased for years, but will actually be ready this year. So we're just doing a lot of fun stuff that I thought I never in my wildest dreams thought that, you know, 15 years later, I would be doing a sequel to Intruder.
Yeah, right.
So I'm excited to do more of Tom's adventures and, just keep working on Toonami.
So, finally, do you keep up with anime? Do you keep up with the season and like see what's airing and, you know, sort of pick and choose the stuff that you might be interested in?
Yes, to a degree. I don't as much as a fan can because I have too many other things going on,
right.
But I do with certain shows and I do when I can. I'm not as caught up as I would like to be. Like, I don't know exactly where every arc of every show is right now. But I have watched all of the shows and I'm a fan of all of the shows, and certain shows like Kill la Kill, that's a show I'll see every episode of.
Right.
I might not be able to watch all 600 episodes of One Piece, even though I do love One Piece.
Right.
But it's like a train. It just never stops, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like, so what I'll do is when I have time and I'm on vacation, I'll just binge watch a bunch of some show, catch myself up. But, you know, luckily we have a staff. So it's like one of our editors might know Shippuden better than any of the rest of us, whereas Gil will know a certain show better than any of the rest of us. So we all have sort of our specialties.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very hard to watch 6 hours of TV. I mean, sorry, 3.5 hours of TV every week and be totally caught up. It's just hard.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that wraps us up. It was an absolute pleasure having you on the show, and thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me, Zach. Thank you.
Okay, that's our show. Big thanks to Jason for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating, a review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.